Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Ooh.
Sci-fi.
Yes, sci-fi, sci-fi, ooh, sci-fi. A hey. Podcast in which three possibly dead men.
Demoniac?
Yes. Demoniac. Horrible, hideous men.
Spooky.
Halloween.
Discuss science fiction and or fantasy audiobooks and review them and then come back for a thorough, life-destroying, spoiling.
I prefer the term soul-sucking.
Soul-sucking. Well, you know.
That's just day-to-day life. Come on.
That's true.
Get back to work in your box, boy.
Yes. Today we are reviewing the first half of The Necronomicon by H.P. Lovecraft.
Not the story, The Necronomicon. The collection.
Nor the imaginary book, The Necronomicon, yes, which if we actually read it, we would go mad. It would be completely redundant in our case.
Oops.
Yes, it's the very marketable but very confusingly titled Necronomicon.
Exactly. Oh, wow, he finally published it. I'm going to read it and The King in Yellow and go completely insane. I wear no mask. Sorry, that will leave that for our King in Yellow.
Time is a flat circle.
Review. Yeah, that'll be a whole lot of references. Anyway, yes. So, Kevin, do you have any kind of summary that you want to give us?
Well, these stories are written between 1917 and 1935 by H.P. Lovecraft. As you said, we're doing the first half, so that is Dagon, Herbert West Reanimator, The Lurking Fear, The Rats in the Walls, The Whisper in Darkness, Cool Air in the Vault, The Call of Cthulhu, The Color Out of Space, and The Horror at Red Hook. So, yes.
Okay.
Well, the back of the book says, originally written for the pulp magazines of the 1920s and 30s, H.P. Lovecraft's astonishing tales blend elements of horror, science fiction, and cosmic terror that are as powerful today as they were when first published. At least that's part of it.
Yep. Oh, so we're just doing that first half of the summary.
Let's go along with the first half of the book.
Yeah. I edited it. I guess I could throw in some other things. This is technically an Appendix N book. It's the first one I think we've actually done on the podcast. Appendix N, which we did previously reference, which being an appendix in the Dungeons & Dragons, the Player's Handbook or DM's Guide, I can't remember now.
Yes.
Basically a list of things that Gygax says, hey, these inspired me to create Dungeons & Dragons, the role-playing game, if for some reason you haven't heard of it. So
that's a thing.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, he just lists H.P. Lovecraft. He doesn't list any particular thing. So I guess technically anything he's written inspired him to make D&D.
His grocery list.
Exactly.
Milk, eggs, horrible, horrible meat.
The note he left for his cousin to do the laundry.
Exactly.
Yes, that could be terrorizing.
Cultist robes. Small clothes.
I don't think cultists wear small clothes.
It's one of the few perks. All right, Barry, what did you think of this?
So I think this is probably my third or fourth listening of, you know, some of these stories. And I think that maybe some of our current climate is desensitizing me to some of the horror that...
Just like, oh no, a big monster's going to eat us all. You know, that would be great.
It's the blonde-haired monster, run. You know, it's still enjoyable. You know, it's thoroughly, you know, into the classic zone at this point. So I think that if you hadn't read it before, and you should probably take a listen, and if you have, it's probably still just as scary as it was before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, my take on it is kind of Lovecraft be Lovecraftin'. I mean, which is wrong on, yes, so many levels. He is unique, and that might be a good thing. But if you're unfamiliar with Lovecraft, then I don't know really what to say. I mean, he's very influential. He's got a very, very opaque style. I mean, we were sort of brainstorming about a drinking game about, you know, drink the first time that he says, you know, hideous.
Cyclopean.
Cyclopean.
Every sentence that has more than three adjectives in it, you must take a drink.
And die of alcohol poisoning, like Poe.
Yes.
You know, I think that it should be said on the outset that his viewpoint is very, very racist. I think that that's just a fact, given just the sheer amount of horrible racial references that are in there. If that sort of thing is going to turn you off, I would not recommend reading this. And yeah, if it does turn you off, I congratulate you. I mean,
he does lay it on a little thick.
A little, yeah. I mean, laying it on a little thick is kind of his job. I mean, that's what he's doing in this. I mean, he apparently didn't talk quite like this in ordinary speech. You know, he didn't say, "Go to the hideous grocery store."
I'm now applying this methodology to many of the other authors we've listened to and wondering when they go to the grocery store. Get the J-E-L-L-Y.
Moving on.
Mason jar.
I didn't say it. Where was I? Anyway, Lovecraft, for me, he's sort of like this, "Oh my God, this tastes weird. Hey, try this."
Yeah, because it's kind of interesting. He's definitely kind of referenced by all sorts of people and things, and his stuff is definitely interesting. Some of it's sort of terrifying because of, you know, racism or other reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, some of it is actually terror or horror fiction, you know, as in, i.e. somewhat scary, but, you know, by I don't know. It's rare that I'm like, "Oh, I'm scared."
Sort of feeling of revulsion, and he was trying to evoke a feeling of revulsion, but I'm not necessarily feeling the feeling of revulsion that he was going for, but I'm still feeling it.
I mean, there are other authors that did weird fiction, right?
Yes.
And so he's probably the most famous one for it. And there are plenty of other people at the time that published it. It's just that I think he's the one that's most remembered for it. And, you know, there's a lot of his stuff that's, you know, made its way into movies and things like that too. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, part of the reason why I've read some of these is because of the whole like appendix N of like, well, I might as well eventually read this, you know, basis for D&D stuff since I like D&D. But it's also interesting to go back and read sort of early versions of things where this is sort of like before there was science fiction, really, before there was, you know, well-defined genres, he was sort of doing this. And of course they had genres back then, but they were much more like he was groping for it, and it kind of goes all over the place. And I think that's one thing that's interesting with like weird fiction is it's sort of like some horror and science fiction elements, but a lot of science in it.
Right.
You know, so he definitely like, you know, for the day, he puts in a lot of references and then maybe puts it on their head to make it into something that isn't real. But, you know, he'll reference like, you know, the discovery of Pluto,
right,
as a plot point, you know, where some outer darkness lives or something, or he'll reference like non-Euclidean spaces and geometry as like, you know, how these weird interdimensional beings might, you know, get in and out or something. And like, you know, talks about Einstein and relativity, and, you know, so he mentions a lot of science. And, you know, he himself, you know, studied to be an astronomer early on, and he had, you know, written quite a few things like, you know, astrology is BS and stuff. So he's not really a person that talks about that kind of stuff. You know, he tried to be accurate to what he believed science was.
So I think for his day, I think this would actually probably be, you know, considered science fiction. You know, some of the stories he wrote about, you know, heads being, you know, preserved in glass containers and being able to travel to the stars isn't
right.
That's significantly different than, you know, sort of like, you know, out of body experiences like that we see in sci-fi today.
Sure. And we can get into that in the discussion section.
No, I demand we do it now.
You can demand it. Yes. But I'm going to cut your head off and keep it preserved forever.
There's a jar right there.
If we plug it into
the weirdest bluff calling I've ever seen. Sorry, officer.
He triple dog dared me to do it. So I did it. Well, anyway, and he put his head into Fridgie McFridgerton. And,
yes.
And it is kind of funny too, like with the science references back, things that at the time were considered real. So he's like talking about the Piltdown Man and then and stuff like that, which, you know, now we know is a hoax, but at the time it was considered just breaking, you know, cutting edge.
Obviously
science,
my attempts to curtail this discussion have been too subtle. Oh no, there's a knock at the door. Let's see who it is.
It's Cthulhu.
Yes. Oh no, let me get my special embalming fluid ready and my needle.
Yes.
I am here to serve.
Yes. All right. Well, okay, we've got this body to take care of, but we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our podcast, where we shall discuss the first half of Lovecraft's The Necronomicon until that hand appears at the window.
The rats, the rats. And that burst of cold air. Yes.
Exactly. All right. So shall we begin? Do we have favorites? Does not seem like a particularly
most memorable
moments.
Well, you can still, you know, maybe a favorite story or parts of a story or something.
Yes.
I mean, I guess still probably, well, the two ones that I probably are most well known from this are Herbert West Reanimator and The Whisper and Darkness.
Right.
And probably the most famous out of context is The Call of Cthulhu, because that's, I think that was the first one where they, right, they talked about Cthulhu, or at least one of the first.
Like, Call of Cthulhu, or as I like to think of it, the darker version of Close Encounters. What is it? Oh, it's a monster. Let's go visit.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess my for me, one of the standout moments is in Herbert West Reanimator, where, I mean, I really can't tell. Sometimes it seems like it's verging into comedy, and sometimes it's going for absolute horror. And I can't tell how much of that was deliberate. I remember reading someplace that some of it was actually deliberately designed to be funny.
I could see that. I mean, the thing that threw me for a loop on that book at first was the fact that it was a serial, which I didn't realize until I was like, why did they keep repeating, like, you know, kind of what's going on? And then I realized that each chapter had its own name, and I was like, oh, this is a serial. And I looked it up and I'm like, yep, it was a serial.
Yeah, yes. I kept thinking I was having that Audible bug again, where it was bringing me back to previous chapters, and I was like, this, I'm like, god damn it.
But at one point there, you know, Herbert West the Reanimator has been plagued by having, you know, all of these disgusting old dead bodies, and rather than just going to Body Fresh, our new sponsor, he finally gets this amazing stroke of luck, as he describes it. This guy sort of literally knocks on his door and drops dead. And
well, that's what he said.
That's what he says to his Renfield, his yes, his accomplice.
There's no one here to dispute that fact.
And
except the body.
Except the body. You know, they sort of halfway reanimated, and it says sort of this, you know, in regularly plain language, is just like, get away from me with that needle, you stupid toe-headed fiend.
Yeah. And, you know, he's like, damn it, it wasn't fresh enough. And he kept sort of complaining about that. And
was that the body that ran into the woods?
I know
that was the other doctor
track.
Well, yeah, that was actually, I would say, one of visually, you know, that was kind of one of the things that stood out was the towards the end, there's this, you know, one of the dead bodies, you know, they say, oh, it's this beautiful man. And then they realize it was a wax sculpture of someone's head that had glass eyes. And then the guy's head was in a box that, like, his minions carried around, which were the other things. And it was,
yeah,
just
that,
like,
was my absolute favorite.
Yeah. And that visual was just like, wow, that's really awesome. Like, I could totally imagine this as, like, setting or something.
And it's sort of horrific and yet kind of funny.
Right. And
I've got a prosthetic head.
And the funny thing is, yeah, he doesn't, like, strap on his fake head, because I guess that would be in poor condition probably. So he has this other one. And the funny thing is that, you know, quite a few times they had tried to reanimate something and it hadn't gone well, and so they just reburied it, and it turned out, I guess, it was still undead or whatever, and they didn't realize it or didn't care. I don't know.
Right.
And so
these two really weren't all that bright.
But the thing that I thought was interesting about it was, you know, probably my brain was adding more than was there, but, unless it was sort of very subtly implied where, you know, it's like, okay, what's happening is, you know, over many, many years, they built up, you know, quite a few of these, you know, dead bodies, you know, that are just walking around. But there seems to be something that...
We intended well. We bought an incinerator.
Right. Well, there seems to be something that actually is like mentally...
Bodies are always a complication. What was it? Bodies are always a problem.
Yeah, something like that.
Nuisance.
Yeah, nuisance. And so like all of these like, you know, undead, whatever they are, like, you know, are kind of drawn to each other somehow. So they find each other. And then like, you know, there's... they kind of mentioned in passing, oh, there was this guy that Herbert West was formerly friends with that had kind of helped him do some of these experiments. And then he's the guy who happened to crash land, you know, on the battlefield.
Right.
And his head was like almost completely severed. So he's like, oh, ooh, ooh. And like, you know, he like cuts his head off and like, you know, cook, let's do it. And it's like,
we can find out if the body is still intelligent without its head. It's just like, why would that make any sense according to your mechanistic worldview?
There's a hind brain. It's located in my butt.
He sort of figured that every piece of the body was, you know, usable by itself, and he wanted to test it. And of course, he kind of went a little nuts, but
a little bit, teeny bit.
But yeah, that's the character who later on has the wax head, and they don't explicitly say that, but you kind of figure it out. And they basically go in. You know, one of the first ones that they find that has been reanimated was...
I'm imagining this wax headroom joke. Yeah. I am wax, wax.
Well, I'm still imagining some sort of like, you know, reanimated support group.
Well, this wax headroom is a place where they got dead bodies, right?
Okay, great. But anyway, yes. So this was a fellow reanimator. And so some of the troop that was following him around was probably, you know, he would go to these graves. He would probably just go to fresh graves and dig people up to be his slaves.
Right. And so the guy that knew how to do this and then became a body himself with the wax head, he basically like they, you know, at the end, they go to the asylum because it's like, you know, the head of the school that had died in...
No pun intended.
In what? Yes. The cholera epidemic or whatever it was. Who then was reanimated. And of course, everyone's horrified because they're like, what, this creature that had been like biting and eating people, like, you know...
Looks just like this saint of the community.
Yeah, that's weird. And of course, you know, yeah, he's been reanimated. They don't even tell you that they did that. They just sort of mention it in, you know, later on.
Well, I get the feeling that if anybody dies in that story, then...
Yeah, basically.
If they're mentioned, then they're probably reanimation meat. Mm-hmm.
And so they... I thought it was interesting because they're breaking him out of the thing because like, hey, he's one of the reanimated group. And
all right.
So, yes. Yeah.
So, anyway. Okay. Barry.
Yes.
Did you have any standout moments that you would like to share with us?
In general or from the book?
Why not in general?
Well, no. I think that I really like the color from beyond or...
Color from space.
The color from space. The
color out of space.
Out of space, yes.
Out of space, yes.
The blob one kind of...
It's mauve.
Yes. It might be taupe colored. Taupe. In some ways, it reminded me a little of, you know, sort of the, what was it, the pastoral, you know, catastrophe type story.
Oh, cozy catastrophes?
Cozy catastrophe, yeah. And a little bit, you know, it's a sort of, it's just, you know, it's set on a farm and there's sort of like this, you know, thing in the well that they haven't really figured out what it is. And it's just sort of slowly taking people, but it's not like it's a very slow building, at least to me, disaster.
Mm-hmm. Right. He was really concerned with toxic waste and stuff in the environment, I think.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was an early opponent of, you know, pesticides. You know, it's like the animals on the farm would start coming up, you know, sort of rotting and, you know, getting sick and falling apart.
And I guess Lovecraft is somewhat to blame for our evil scientists stereotype meme, because it's the scientists who are sort of blundering in and make it worse by saying, oh, right, that's a funny looking thing, let's put a pickaxe to it.
Oh, it's totally normal.
Maybe we'll find another one.
Well, if we find at least three, you could establish a pattern, right?
Right.
Right.
And so, yeah, you got the impression of this ethereal realm that this color could exist in. And after it infected you, you could kind of see in it.
Yeah.
Which actually seemed kind of D&D to me, because there's always the ethereal realm you can go into in D&D, I guess.
There's many planes of existence, Steven. Right.
Well, thank you, a wise one.
And pedantic rant.
All right. Okay. Let's see. Rest of the usual questions. Was there tea? Oh, God, I hope not.
I don't think so. I did search for tea in all the stories, and I didn't find the word tea anywhere.
Herbert West, tea reanimator. I shall rewarm it in the microwave.
It's actually far worse than that.
And let's see. Which character would you want to be, and or would you be? Well, even when you're dead, you're not safe in this one. I wouldn't want to be anybody. I can't even imagine who the best person to be would be.
Cthulhu.
Well, sure. Then at least you get a nice long nap.
Yes.
It's a surprisingly hard sentence to say. But yes, Cthulhu, that would be a nice person to be.
I'd like to be Haster.
So, I mean, one of the problems is that since everybody is sort of indescribable and unknowable, I'm not entirely sure. I mean,
there's a difference.
Let's see. I know Yogg-Sothoth is just supposed to be like these spheres or something like that. And he's like,
yeah, there was one that I don't remember which one it was now, but it was funny because it was like, it was the idiot god that was something. And I was like, oh, it's like the, the space vampires.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. There's no one in here that you're like, ooh, he's pretty cool. I want to be like, you know, I want to be like them or whatever. It's like there's weird monsters. I mean, you know, you kind of figure, well, I'd like to be one of the intellectuals who didn't do anything really, really bad and didn't end up tortured to death or undead or something. But
I want to be one of the people whose, you know, consciousness was replaced with an alien one and, you know, walk the earth learning, you know, strange things. And meanwhile, my consciousness is, you know, back on the alien planet.
Yeah, actually, Whisperer in the Darkness was one of my favorite ones of his, because I had never understood that he had gotten into like brain transplants. And I mean, that's all very science fictional stuff.
It kind of went crazy off the rails after a while.
Oh, absolutely. But that was the best part.
Yeah. No, that was definitely interesting. It was a long lead up to, and here's another letter that I kind of remember.
I think I wrote it. Maybe I didn't.
Yeah.
It's in my handwriting, but.
Yeah. Watch out for the crab creatures. Yeah. Actually, that was one thing I thought was interesting, too, was how there was a lot of different kinds of stories. I mean, you know, there's kind of like the general weird fiction that you think of. And then, you know, there's some overlap with, you know, his like mythos stories where it's like, you know, it's like he was, I don't know if he was the first author, but he was kind of one of the first ones that would kind of create this mythos across his stories, even though they weren't connected directly, right, with Cthulhu and all that stuff. But then there were some that I would consider like, you know, ghost stories or campfire stories.
Well, I mean, even like the horror at Red Hook was interesting, right? Because it's basically, it's got that Cthulhu mythos to it, but it's really more like an organized crime, you know, element to it as well.
Right.
Yeah. So, and, well, speaking of Red
slightly,
Hook,
slightly disorganized, I don't know.
Let's talk about racism. I mean, there was some discussion we were having about the usual, was Lovecraft, you know, racist, or was he just of his time? And I did a little bit of research, and as far as I could tell,
why
the answer
both?
Is
both.
Yes. I mean, he was living at what is happily called the nadir of American race relations. You know, was after the slaves had been freed, but there were still the Jim Crow laws and Plessy versus Ferguson and all kinds of happy stuff like that. And, but even his contemporaries were like, you know, Lovecraft, you might want to, you know, rein that in a little bit. Apparently, like, the horror of Red Hook was largely based on him moving to Red Hook. They would apparently go on the street and Lovecraft would be like, look at all these crowds of mixed race people and mixed race crowds and all this stuff. You know, it just would freak him out. I mean, you know.
Yeah, he did describe several other races as, what, Mongoloid and,
I guess one of the most amazing ones was in Herbert West when he was describing a boxer that he reanimated, and he just was completely describing you know, a normal guy. I had to sort of go back and understand, oh no, he's talking about just a guy, you know, who's black. And so he's just like, oh, his arms, or as I should call them, what was it, four legs?
Yeah, it was really, yeah, really horrible.
I'm just like, wow. And this, I mean, is just a guy.
I mean, it's like, even like, it's like a, you know, a step beyond like, you know, crazy racist, you know, grandpa or something, right?
Yeah.
Right. And that, even in that's in that story in Herbert West, that was that thing where he, you know, they had made a point of saying, well, animals need different formula than people. And then it's like, that was the problem, is like, oh, we'd only tested it on white people. And yeah, this one didn't work. And like, wow, it was like, oh my, I had to go back. I'm like, wow, he did just put that. Yeah,
he said that. He said that. And that's, I mean,
maybe this was like an early warning about, you know, only training AIs with, you know, specific data sets, yes, as they've been discussing lately in the internet, so to speak.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are people that sort of defend him. I don't think that that's necessary or terribly useful. I mean, yeah, he grew up in a very sheltered white bread community, and then he moved to the big city and that freaked him out. And these are just facts about him.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody's calling for, you know, burning all of his books or anything, but, you know, it certainly has to be taken with a few grains of salt there, right? You know, right. You're,
and it's not like he was ashamed of his racism or tried to keep it out. I mean, the racism is kind of a core of the books. It's kind of like the revulsion that he's feeling in, you know, oh my God, this inhuman thing is corrupting these people, is kind of like a redirected racism. It's kind of the, so you do have to understand that that's part of the fiction.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's necessary to ban his book. I wouldn't recommend it for children, not because of the racism, but because A, it would be really gross, and B, they wouldn't understand what the hell he was saying.
Yeah. I think it would also be like, you know, just trying to get to the first couple of pages would be just pretty painful for
right,
you know, probably anybody like under 16, I don't know.
Right. So it's a self-solved problem, really. Yeah. But I do think it is necessary to say, yes, Lovecraft was a racist. The sky is blue. These are just facts.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like, you know, any of his contemporary authors were like, you know, we're not telling you not to write Herbert, but maybe you could just tone it down just a little bit. No, no, I'm going to double down on it.
I mean, it wasn't a lot of comment, as far as I understand it, but there were people that said, hey, you know, dude, party foul. I mean, that was a direct quote, of course.
Over the line, Donnie, over the line.
Let's see. Okay, so genre. Yeah, we were talking about horror versus science fiction versus weird tales, that genre was a little bit looser back then.
Right. I mean, because he's definitely, you know, there's another piece that he's written where it's basically, here's a review of the last 300 years of horror fiction, and he kind of reviews everything that he's heard of, which is actually really interesting.
Right. And if you're interested in that, I suggest listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, which actually goes through, it started out reviewing all of Lovecraft's stuff and now is actually going through that document and reviewing everything that he ever said, oh, this is good, or anything that is somewhat Lovecraftian.
Right. You know, you could see some definitely feel kind of like Poe or something, where it's like this romanticism, you know, dark romanticism, where it's like you're, it's the setting that's creepy, right? You know, it's mm-hmm. like this creepy house, and like, you know, nothing much happens in the story other than there's a bunch of unknown creepy things, and
right,
you know, maybe then something does happen, the house burns down or whatever, but it's not really described directly. A lot of his stuff does, you know, they do go into the whole like, oh, you know, it's unnameable or whatever.
Yeah. My favorite was, what was it? I think it was the lurking fear, where it, yeah, goes on for a really long time. And you know, I really thought that he was just never going to get down to actually what the fear was.
Right. Right. Yeah. It goes through a lot of stuff, and
the fear struck on this day.
Well, I think there's also an element of, you know, when these stories were published, it was a much bigger world,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of, you know, just moving around, like even like within the United States. Right. So them, you know, basically going, you know, to the other side of the state, which, you know, in the East Coast is to us right now, isn't that big a deal. You hop in your car, you drive there, you know, a couple hours away.
Right. And so the idea of a remote section of Massachusetts seems a little weird.
You're like, there is no such thing.
Right. It's just like, and those wilds of Rhode Island.
It takes at least 3 minutes to cross.
Exactly. Well, I mean, even in the case where, you know, there was one story that we were listening to where, and I don't remember which one it was, but basically there was like this big, you know, back and forth, you know, letter writing discussion about which train they were going to be on.
Right. The whisper in darkness. Yeah. Huh?
You know, and it's like, yeah, I kind of would think that that would require some sort of, you know, we have cell phones these days, right? You're like, hey, I'm going to be on the 4 o'clock train, you know, whereas before it's like, if you didn't even have a telephone, you know, a plain old telephone right. line, you know, you had to write a letter and say, hey, I'm going to be there on say the 17th at 4 PM, but I'd really like to be there earlier. What do you think? You know, you don't want to ask these ambiguous right. questions.
And then you would have to have somebody sent to meet you, or else how are you going to know how to get there? Because
right.
no mapping application.
Right. I mean, not even like a lot of paper maps, right? I mean,
right.
And, you know, before paper maps were expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, AAA sort of solved that problem by, you know, like, hey, everybody, here's all these free maps and here's how you get around the United States. And
right. Exactly. I mean, yeah,
that was a, you know, quote, big thing.
Right. It was a major boon. I mean, granted, it may have destroyed the earth through greenhouse gas emissions, but aside from that, yay.
Just inhale deeply from behind the car.
Yay.
I feel better already. It's so warm.
So, smell the future.
Like that one, like the In the Vault story where it's like nothing happens right, really, until the very end, where it's basically like it's this, you know, Undertaker guy that's basically just like always cutting corners and he just sort of locks himself.
Oh, there's another pun.
And you know, you have this thing, you're like, well, what's going on? Is there like some zombie in there or something? You know, is there something, you know, scary in the vault? You know,
it's like Undertaker gets his comeuppance for basically being spiteful to one of his clients.
I mean, that was one of his most straightforward stories in some ways.
And I kind of liked it because it was like, you could retell it because it was so simple, right? You know, right. It was like
that's
the campfire horror story. Or
exactly.
And, you know, where it's just like, and they save the punchline to the very, very, very last sentence in the entire thing.
And oh boy, does he draw that one out. Just like, and never tell anyone about this thing I'm going to say. Ooh, gonna tell you.
It's like, cut his feet off.
Yeah, to cut his feet off, didn't you?
Yeah. To fit in the old reused coffin.
The recycled coffin.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of his definite, you know, more magical reality sorts of stories. I mean, it's hard to imagine, unless this is sort of like, and then he buried him alive and cut his feet off.
Right. Yeah, that's true. He doesn't flinch at doing, you know, things related to the undead, obviously, but...
Or to the dead. Yeah. Or to the living.
But yeah, it's true that a lot of his, you know, he does seem to have sort of like the outer darkness, you know, the universe is so vast and uncaring and that kind of stuff where it's just, you know, we'll never be able to understand it. And if we try to, we'll just go mad, you know.
Okay. And this is just a thing. Apparently Lovecraft was originally going to go into astronomy and the math was too hard for him. And so I sort of have this, you know, pet fan theory of, you know, instead of him thinking, oh, I'm just not that good at math, he's just like, there are some things man was not meant to know. Just like, no, dude, calculus is just hard.
But fun.
So useful.
I never took calculus.
A common thing that goes through several stories is this, you know, kind of like the angles weren't right, or the other geometries where it's kind of like this concept of, you know, higher math.
Curves.
Where, right. Yeah, he'd be like, oh, you know, these acute angles that act as if they were obtuse, and he would like fall into some other room somehow, even though it looked like that wasn't really the, you know, portal some in... You know, they would even talk about like...
So he's really in the mystery spot in Santa Cruz?
Yeah, basically.
This entire thing actually took place in the mystery spot in Santa Cruz.
And all he had got was that stupid bumper sticker.
Well, it was pretty funny too, because, you know, they talk about, you know, was it Relier or whatever, where Cthulhu is supposed to be dreaming, you know, asleep under the waves, and like, and they
which
actually
always brings to mind the Cthulhu musical. And who has the might as Rasmaster of Relay to drive the human race insane? Cthulhu. Wow.
Good job.
No, no, that, that yeah, somebody I, actually did the I whole
know.
Musical.
You, I know. You have scraped the bowels of the internet. Thank you.
Yeah, well, he actually gave the lat long, you know, coordinates for where it was supposedly that when the ship found it. And I did a quick search, and there was some other contemporary author who also, you know, they, a lot of people kind of traded the using the mythos in the weird fiction circles. And he gave a similar but not the same location. And so the entry basically says, oh, well, these are basically... there's some special name for it, which I can't remember, but basically it's like as far away as you can get from a major continent.
Oh.
And it actually happens to be like a couple miles, like a couple thousand miles away from some tiny island that's there. So they're like, yep, this is where it is. You know, as far away from, you know, any regular piece of land.
It's the point that's farthest away from any coast of any other major landmass or something.
Like that. Yeah.
The Antipodes, whatever.
Yeah. Something like that. I forget the actual name, but,
I'm curious how he found that himself.
Well, he didn't use that term, but he did give I thought it was weird that he actually gave these lat long coordinates, and I was like, that's so bizarre. And then somebody else gave the similar
geek thing that he would do.
I mean, well, I can imagine looking at a globe and saying, well, where would it be? Oh, as far, you know, this is like where it would be sunken, you know, way in the deeps of the ocean or something. And
I mean, because yeah, he did the research for these stories.
And also, as you said, it's not like they had like, you know, satellites back then or, you know, anything that really had good maps. It was like, you know, it really was, you know, something difficult and unknown, you know, so.
Exactly. Okay. Let's see. You wanted to talk a little bit about its Appendix N status, or did you already cover that?
Yeah, I guess I mostly covered that. It was just, you know, he's one of the authors listed in the Appendix N for, you know, inspiration for D&D creation. So, eventually we'll read more of those, though I think technically this is our first one, I think.
Okay. And did we have anything to say about his style? His hideous, cyclopean, gelatinous style.
Yeah, it's funny because for some reason, cyclopean is the word that jumps out at me. It's like an archaic word that you're like, it sounds cool, but I'm not even sure what the hell that means. And apparently it just means built with large irregular blocks.
Oh, really? I assumed it meant one-eyed.
Well, it also refers to that also, but that's when he talks about it, because he'll say this cyclopean architecture or whatever, but he'll also use it kind of out of context. So you're like, it sounds cool, but I don't know what, you know. So I actually did look it up, and I'm like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the word that jumped out for me was demoniac.
Yeah, that was another.
Which is like a, it's just a you know, an archaic usage.
But right. It, you know, the word hideous always struck me that he would use it always in the first paragraph of his stories.
Just to set the tone.
I guess.
Well, I thought it was interesting too, where there's definitely some of his stuff where it's like, how many adjectives can I cram into this? And so this one, there's a couple sentences that I think are from Call of Cthulhu where they're describing, you know, Cthulhu coming out of Relier, I think it is. And it's like, this is where the ship comes, and it's you know, basically they somehow woke it up when the ship came and
ramming speed.
What does God need with a steamship?
The odor arising from the newly opened depths was intolerable, and at length the quick-eared Hawkins thought he heard a nasty slopping sound down there. Everyone listened, and everyone was listening still when it lumbered slobberingly into sight and gropingly squeezed its gelatinous green immensity through the black doorway into the tainted outside air of that poison city of madness.
Wow. It's like a never-ending stream of adjectives.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not every sentence isn't like that, but like when he kind of hits a climax, he's like, okay, horror, what's another madness? Like, that's good. Like, you know.
I mean, yeah, did he have sort of a special Lovecraft thesaurus right next to him? It's just like, oh, let's reach into the hat.
It's the Cthulhu Wheel of Fortune. Right? You just keep spinning until you get the adjectives you have, you know, I need to hit a certain count. So
we should make sort of the Lovecraft, you know, RPG dice that have all these adjectives. You just roll like five of them and it lists a sentence out basically of all the adjectives you can use.
The Cards of Cthulhu. I'm sure that's been done.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yes, well, speaking of cities of madness, also something that seems to happen really easily is people going insane. It's just like, and then I saw something nasty behind the woodshed, and now I'm insane. Ha ha ha.
Yeah, I mean, that is sort of like a big thing of his.
Well, I mean, didn't his father, wasn't his father insane?
Wasn't he insane?
Well, that's open to some conjecture. I mean, apparently he was a more or less a fairly collected guy. I mean, yes, to his friends, shall we say. You know,
people of like mind.
People of like mind and visage. I mean, a lot of people described him as, oh, he's just a nice guy. And it's, you know, it's just Howard.
Howie.
But
that zany Howie guy.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of the people in these stories were not necessarily suffering. He would just say madness. And nowadays we would say it was PTSD, something like that. Somebody who had seen something terrible and didn't have the life-saving influence of video games to drive it out of their minds.
Exactly.
Sorry, that's referring to an article I read once where, you know, if you see something really terrible, then you should immediately play an addictive video game.
Yeah. Quick, get Tetris or something.
Watch more YouTube.
Exactly. It just seemed like the minds of people in his universe were very, very fragile.
Well, that's a common thing with like RPGs that are based on it, but also that
I hadn't thought of that. So if you fail your spirit roll.
Well, especially in, you know, Cthulhu direct RPGs, but there are other RPGs where there's like the sanity thing. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty common thing when something, you know, if you see this like horrible monster or someone's like really critically injured, it's like, okay, do your sanity check. See if you, you know, kind of go mad from this or at least have some problems for a while.
I believe it's time for not this podcast just to end, but possibly the world. So I believe it is time for us to summon Cthulhu
in his house of Relay. Dead Cthulhu waits dreaming.
There he is. He's on the horizon.
The hand, the tentacle, the thingy.
The weird colored thing.
Gorgo Mormo, thousand-faced moon.
Yay. Yay, Cthulhu. All right. Well, until next time, if such a time exists,
take us first.
We Beyond have been time.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi. Sci-fi.